I'm going to share with you a little bit of the research I've done, which I alluded to before about the Black Knight legend, the Black Knight satellite. But what that unturned, it was a diversion, but this diversion is a good one, very interesting thus far, because they brought up this supposed extraterrestrial repeating source, which is the long distance echo. Supposedly heard, they say, during the 1899 radio experiments of Nikola Tesla. These long delayed echoes then are said to have next been heard by amateur radio operator Jorgen Hals in Oslo, Norway in 1928. The long distance echoes are an interesting topic because if you think about the realm and how you would figure out what is beyond the veil, because space isn't exactly the way it's been presented to us. We know what it's not. We know when they give us CGI and stories about rogue planets and whatever the main scientific figure is of the time, such as Stephen Hawking, who's a fabrication himself. Speaking of things like the Higgs boson, particles, dark matter, all these types of things are being presented by somebody who is himself a presentation, not a person who has any sort of veracity about him as a character, because we are expected to believe that somebody with the condition. It's so anomalous, I'll put it that way. Anomalous in so many different ways, and dubious, I would add, because if you compared just the reality of things versus what's presented in the person of Stephen Hawking, just like others, you'll start to find issues with that. But then you get into what they're saying, and there are even more issues. Basically, we've covered what things are not, and I don't necessarily think my time is best spent convincing you of that. You're here to find out what is, and I have the same interest and have found some things. Long distance echoes are, like is described, they are echoes of radio waves. They can be picked up coming from out there somewhere. And I'm not talking about the data streams from the tape deck of the 14 billion mile distant Voyager probe broadcast at something like 20 watts. I can never remember the number. It's so ridiculously low as to be negligible. No, I'm not talking about that in this case. Nor am I talking about the sources from out there, whatever that would be, the cosmic radiation background noise, which would far exceed the signal of any such probe that distant or even much less distant. No, I'm talking about radio echoes. And so when they broadcast a very strong signal, broadcasting at great power, that when you broadcast into what should be outer space where you shouldn't receive an echo, they indeed receive echoes. And this happens at differing, well, inputs return differing results. When you broadcast these signals at different frequencies, the returns come back a little bit differently sometimes. There are multiple returns, so it's not a single echo, but multiple echoes, which is also of interest. And then determining the time of day or the location of when these certain frequencies are broadcast yields information about how those variables affect the echo time. And it gets very complicated, but what I found to pique my interest, among other things, was the fact that the results confounded scientists to this very day. So we're talking about something that was first noticed, supposedly, and probably at least over 100 years ago. And then has yielded further study, which has resulted in a lot of interesting information without any definitive conclusions. Not that I would necessarily put much trust in or place a whole lot of value on the conclusions of those results from the people who would be giving them, and I mean scientists. Does that shock you? Well, I'm talking about not just any scientists, but I am talking about astrophysicists. Popular science published in reputable journals that have been peer-reviewed. They have passed the peer pressure of peer-reviewed journals, which is like saying that they've received awards from mutual admiration societies that are condoned and sanctioned in a positive way by the elite of the world, the billionaires, the universities, etc. So that's where I'm coming from, and I'm glad you're here. So let's get into it. In 1932, American physicist and radio engineer Carl Jansky detected radio waves coming from an unknown source in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Jansky was studying the origins of radio frequency interference for Bell Laboratories. He found a steady hiss-type static of unknown origin, which eventually he concluded had an extraterrestrial origin. This was the first time that radio waves were detected from outer space. So this is 1932, and they're saying that here on Wikipedia about astronomical radio sources, which I'll cover first before I talk about echoes. The first radio sky survey was conducted by Grote Reber and was completed in 1941. In the 1970s, some stars in the Milky Way were found to be radio emitters. Those aren't echoes, but those are radio sources. But we need to cover those first because that's how I got into this when I was looking for information about the so-called Black Knight satellite. And so, what were they up to? Well, they were up to no good. We'll see. They were postulating about mini black holes and looking into Hawking radiation, although this would have been later on, trying to find information about the Big Bang, developing more theories with more questions for more research. Right. We have to cover this because, yes, there are radio waves that I believe really are coming from out there, whatever is out there. And that's what we're here to find out. What are the limits of this realm and what is out there beyond the veil? How far does it go? And there are some interesting results because with echoes, you can find that. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that's capital SETI, that project looked at extraterrestrial communications in the form of narrowband signals, which would be analogous to our own radio stations. There has been a lot of listening going on, at least, and broadcasting. And so that's where we get into this information of anomalies. So the sky is known to have all kinds of objects, transient objects, the lights in the sky, and other things maybe not associated with one of the lights in the sky that move overhead, that are emitting X and gamma ray wavelengths and many other types of radio waves all over the electromagnetic spectrum. So obviously more than just light. When I talk about the lights in the sky, they're more than just lights because they emit wavelengths from the electromagnetic spectrum of all different types. We've even explored the idea of sound waves, but without the medium for sound to travel, they are silent. But if they were very local, we can theorize, reasonably so, that they would make sound. But more than that, they emit all kinds of electromagnetic waves on the electromagnetic spectrum versus sound, something else. But some of them are repeating sources. And so that takes us back to 1899 with the radio experiments of Nikola Tesla, because technically what he heard is listed as a repeating source, a natural repeating source, not necessarily just an echo from broadcasting, but just from receiving. We know for sure the first listing of what was determined to be long-delayed echoes is 1928 with the experiments in Oslo, Norway, Brian Dunning. So Nikola Tesla, the brilliant Serbian inventor, thought to be a mad scientist, an electrical engineer, explored the idea of radio waves and wireless transmissions. And in 1899, he reportedly intercepted a signal unlike any of the natural sources from Earth, such as from electrical storms that he had already investigated in other experiments. He announced that regular signals must be coming from an intelligent outside source. And so this is where they say that he said potentially inhabitants of Mars. Now, I don't know about that. But they very specifically say that he never claimed to have heard signals from any satellite orbiting Earth, which brings that into question because it's apophasis when they have to go out of their way to say that that's not what he heard. Well, if not that, I've already covered that with the Black Knight satellite. Let's look at the other possibility of the thing that they kind of talk about without saying that's what he heard. That would be the long distance echoes. That may have been what he was talking about, but regardless of the fact of whatever he was talking about, since I don't put a lot of weight into it and we don't know, because it's a little sketchy, the information, we can look to other sources of information when it actually became a thing that people started looking into, the LDEs, these long delayed echoes, because other radio operators, amateur radio operators, were finding their signals originally of earthly origin, of course, were echoing back with bizarre timing. A signal would be received, and then a second repeat of that signal would be received around maybe a few seconds later. These long delayed echoes, known as LDEs, were difficult for them to explain in terms of radio waves bouncing off atmospheric layers. Fast forward to 1973, the Scotsman Duncan Lunan, who was born in 1945, went back and looked at some of these signals to see if he could make sense of the data. And so he plotted the delay times to find any sort of order in which the echoes were received to chart it out to be something recognizable. He thought he had found something coming back from something in proximity to the moon, roughly speaking. Now, keep in mind, his last name is Lunan, and so this has marks of another presentation by the system where they are kind of making it up just by going by the last name. But we'll just put a pin in that for now. It's just something I notice sometimes when I'm trying to sift through and decipher some of the bullcrap to find the true data from the nonsense. But what gives it a little bit more clout in my mind in this case is that they say that he was not a professional astronomer, but he was a science fiction author with a flair for crazy ideas. Sounds familiar. Man after my own heart. So he had interest in the long delay echoes. As time goes on, there were more experiments, and the results were bizarre. Some of the signals echoing back several seconds after the initial transmission that I believe Tesla in the first case documented, it lasted for a time. In that sense, they were long delayed echoes, although transient. And so 80 years after that, still without a conclusive explanation for what these accounts may have been, these eerie echoes were the perfect target for those with a penchant for conspiracies, yes, like me. So, when you really dig into it, you find that since the beginning of the technology of radio, these echoes are called long delayed echoes, LDEs, have confounded people. And so sometimes they are called radio ghosts, and there are a number of theories about what they could be. So, going back to the observations that took place in Oslo, in 1928, Carl Stormer was trying to measure the height of the Northern Light. This report was made in 1928. He wrote, On February 29 of this year, I received a letter from engineer Jorgen Halls, in which he says, "I herewith have the honor to advise you that at the end of the summer 1927, I repeatedly heard signals from the Dutch shortwave radio transmitter station. At the same time as I heard the telegraph signals, I also heard echoes. I heard the usual echo, which goes round the Earth at an interval of about 1/7 of a second, as well as a weaker echo about 3 seconds after the principal signal had gone. When the principal signal was especially strong, I suppose that the amplitude for the last echo 3 seconds after lay between 1/10 and 1/20 of the principal signal in strength. From where this echo comes, I cannot say for the present. I will only herewith confirm that I really heard this echo." Another report in 1934 was made, and the largest ever study done with experimentation on long delayed echoes is the one done over a 2-year period from around 1928 to 1930. Interesting that that would be the largest study. And they used really low frequency wavelengths and did simultaneous observations, different places, different locations, geographical locations, using wavelengths of really long, low frequency wavelengths, extremely low frequency signals of 31.4 meters for the wavelength. These results convinced most skeptics at the time that this effect of long delayed echoes is very real. And they ended the powers of the time that are probably this all the same as today in their agendas. They ended and terminated further study at that time because of the lack of conclusions regarding the mechanism of action that would explain such echoes, and use the excuse of the cost of the equipment as the reason for ending it. Well, that doesn't mean that all experimentation ended with amateur radio groups such as the World Radio Research League in 1934, and others went on conducting a series of experiments with transmitters. They continued to observe these echoes, but didn't gain much more understanding, according to the reports I read, about the phenomenon. Interestingly, there was this idea going on at the time before this that the governments tried to cease all transmissions to observe radio silence for 5 minutes every hour for over a period of 2 days to listen for signals from Mars. Why Mars? What is this? It fascinates me, this idea from Tesla to the 20s, 30s, this idea to today about Mars being a thing like that. I don't know. These long delayed echoes are just not understood officially. There's a lot of mystery surrounding them. They're not properly explained by contemporary science. And so there are some exotic explanations that it could be ducting in the magnetosphere or ionospheric reflection. The radio signals on a ball Earth, when broadcast, if they're reflected by the low angle of the curve, that's how fiber optics work. It's actually a true thing, but it has to have a solid reflective surface. I don't know what that would be, but they say the ionosphere, that the radio signal, when it passes through the lower ionosphere from near the transmitter site, is ducted along the Earth's magnetic field lines across to the other hemisphere of the Earth and back around, and that the echo is when you have the point of convergence on a perfect sphere, the amplitude, because it broadcasts in all directions, the amplitude drops by the inverse square law exponentially, but could be picked up as an echo even at that great distance, which compared to the Voyager is nothing, but just the distance of the circumference of the Earth, that it could be a detectable echo, even though the signal itself would be not detectable from that distance, but because of the convergence, because it's broadcast in all directions, if it were a perfect sphere, it would come back to the same point, and then you have that piling up effect, like you would with rogue waves or hot spots. And if you're an audiophile, you have hot spots and dead spots in a room based on the geometry, kind of the same thing, same idea. So that would explain the echoes in that sense, and that's the prevailing theory about this, that the ducting of the radio waves on the curved path travels the distance of the circumference of the Earth. But the timing of the signal, this is what is fascinating, the timing of the first echo, however, is equivalent in delay, assuming, the speed of the signal's propagation, which is approximated to light speed of 1/7 of a second. That denotes the circumference of the Earth. So the reflection of 1/7 of a second, well, it's not really talked about, but that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, because the delay, that's 143 milliseconds. So in one experiment, which was done in Georgia and in northern England and in St. Petersburg, Russia, they broadcast a frequency, I think it was a number of frequencies actually, between 1 and 4 megahertz. It's a capital M, capital H, lowercase z, megahertz range, with echoing with a duration up to half a second. But they have delays, echo delays. It's 0.143, so it's 143 milliseconds, 211, 251, and 267 milliseconds. And that would be the first number, so 1/7 of a second, and that would be the 143 milliseconds. And they notice, like I said, there are variables. So the delay varies with the geomagnetic latitude, and they've came up with formulas to predict it accurately. So the closer you are to the magnetic north pole that the transmitter is located, the delay is longer. And the shorter delay times, or medium delay echoes, or magnetospherically ducted echoes, rather than LDEs, are the shorter ones that are further away from the magnetic pole. And they include the South Pole in there. I don't, because I think they were all done in the northern, right? The northern hemisphere, the northern latitudes, rather. No, actually, one of them was done in Tasmania. Interesting. Okay, I take that back. But the results, how dubious is it? I don't know. In one report, more recent, there were a total of 59 echoes with a delay between 210 to 220 milliseconds. And that's between 2 to 3.9 megahertz. And double echoes. In Tasmania, they did delay observations with delays 260 to 270 milliseconds at 1.91 megahertz. They duplicated the results with a second receiver 20 kilometers away from the main receiver. And again, in St. Petersburg, they found echo delays 284 to 305. In Georgia, 143 milliseconds at 3.5 megahertz. They have their theories with that. The idea of it going around a spherical Earth, it would be 138 milliseconds exactly. But that's not exactly what they find. The delays are slightly longer. That's why they're called long delayed echoes. Delay of 237 milliseconds were heard in an experiment done in January 2009 in Copenhagen at 3.5 megahertz. So the effect seems to only occur during the dark hours and is most likely to occur between 1900 hours or 7 p.m. and midnight in the local time zone during the winter months of the year, if there is low solar activity, and best at frequencies below 4 megahertz, according to a report done in 1980 by Ellis and Goldstone. I'm sorry, 1990, at least from the write-up. If they're talking about it traveling many times around the world in the ducting idea, that would be consistent with a delay of about 1/7 of a second. And that is something not uncommon. And so it would also explain kind of a reamplification, but again, that's not exactly what they're finding. Okay. So it's, they have other theories besides, but in their second theory of it traveling around the world multiple times, it just doesn't exactly fit because of the accuracy isn't exactly there. And that's not to say that that isn't part of it, but when you're considering you're broadcasting from an omnidirectional antenna and the energy is spreading in all directions, yeah, it would combine on a sphere if it were ducted around the surface of the sphere. It would recombine on the opposite point at the antipodal point of the Earth. And so did they try that? Well, if you pointed the antenna towards the horizon, and you, so Goodacre, 1980, did this. He received his own 28 megahertz signal delayed up to 9 seconds. 9 seconds. Now, given the supposed geometry of the Earth, statistical analysis of a delay should have a periodicity of 0.138 seconds, or the travel time for a signal to go around the spherical Earth. Receiving an echo up to 9 seconds implies 65 times around the Earth. And to achieve this result, he was doing experiments in November and December 1978 and January 1979, about a year before the peak of the solar cycle number 21. So this frequency is probably the upper limit of the effect. So there's some interesting information, but we can't really conclude anything about it, nor could they. But it does raise questions. So the third theory about it is that mode conversion couples to mechanical waves in the ionosphere. So this means that the ionosphere being theorized to have different layers to it, could receive the electromagnetic wave and couple it to a longitudinal plasma wave of a lower group velocity of about 1 kilometer a second, like an ion acoustic wave, whatever that is, so that the energy would travel along the magnetic field lines with the amplification of the plasma wave aiding it, similar to a beam plasma interaction that could happen over 10 kilometers in that region. And then it would have to reverse and go back to electromagnetic energy, back to the receiver to be recognizable as coming from the original source. But experimentally, several echoes were recorded with delays later on, up to 40 seconds. And those authors did not form any conclusions. If a signal broadcast did travel along the surface of the spherical shape of the theorized geometry of the Earth, it would normally be expected to come back to the source point omnidirectionally every 0.138 seconds, 138 milliseconds. But that's not what's happening. And in all the data, I don't think I saw that exact number, 138 milliseconds. There's some that are close, but they're longer. It's long delay. And what about the lesser ones, the medium delay echoes? Well, those are set aside. Yeah. For the third theory, they're saying that it may be more likely to occur when you're in the trailing moon Earth Lagrangian point for your direction of broadcast, as long as it's above the horizon. But they did some experiments to confirm that without success. So that's the best they could do. So the fourth theory or explanation hypothesized about the long delayed echoes is that it would be a reflection from some distant plasma cloud. For this hypothesis to take place, they begin with the assumption that there is a cloud of ionized gases and particles coming from the sun. That wouldn't explain the Doppler shifts and the intensity of the echoes. So they write, the main problem with this hypothesis is that Doppler shifts may easily be too great and received signals too weak. In Alaska, in the auroral zone, using 9.9 megahertz, not 10, 9.9, radio waves were tested to see if they could be guided along the magnetic field lines and be reflected off the so-called solar plasma, where supposedly detected several thousand echoes delayed up to 16 seconds at times, and that the changes in the magnetic field and solar plasma that they're assuming entering the magnetosphere had measurable effects on it. I wouldn't put much faith into that. That would be examples of how echoes were received at the same delay, even when the transmissions were minutes apart. So then the fifth and last of the potential hypothetical explanations offered here in this university paper that I'm reading from as part of overall research would be the nonlinearity plus mode conversion. So VHF and UHF echoes proposed in 1979 by Muldrew assumed the presence of an unknown second transmitter, so such that the nonlinearity generated a different frequency. See, this is interesting too, because sometimes they'll broadcast the signal at one frequency and then the echoes come back at a slightly different frequency. Now, that could be explained if there was this coupling effect that converts the electromagnetic wave to a plasma beam, making it kind of a mechanical wave and then converting back to the electromagnetic wave, and that some kind of problem with that conversion would explain the difference in frequency propagating due to the plasma wave, such that it doesn't come back as the exact original frequency to the observer slash broadcaster or observer, saying that this could have explained not only the different frequencies, but the variations in delay time. So, okay, I mean, that's intelligent. But the echoes in the 50, 144, 432, and 1296 megahertz bands, especially during the attempts of the Earth-Moon-Earth communication. Uh-oh, let's forget about that. That's bad data. Again, you know, all kinds of amateurs are finding these signals broadcast with delays even like 4.6 seconds. By Hans Rasmussen in 1975 at 1296 megahertz. 432 megahertz delay of about 5.75 seconds. What could it be? Couldn't be a firmament or barrier. Couldn't be that there is water up there, that the whole nature of outer space is completely different from what they have been saying. Nah. But, yeah, so Echoes, they think that there's this usual echo, 1/7 of a second. Well, I got into some other studies. So this is one of the most interesting studies I've ever found. And it comes from this abstract of this report made in 1927 by Jorgen Hals of Oslo, when he heard signals from the Dutch shortwave transmitter station in Eindhoven. Going back, there's a reference made in this report. So I'll just read from it. This is public domain. Immediately, I heard of this remarkable observation. It struck me that the wireless waves were reflected from those streams and surfaces of electrons to which I was led by theoretical investigations on the aurora borealis in my paper published in 1904, Sur le mouvement d'un point matériel portant une charge d'électricité sous l'action d'un aimant élémentaire. In reference to that paper, in a subsequent more complete one in Archives de Sciences Physiques et Naturelles, Geneva, 1907, one of the most striking features of the theory was that streams of electrons coming from without toward the Earth were deviated by the Earth's magnetic field in such a way that an immense space was formed free from electric particles. And having the shape of a torus, described by revolution of an oval tangent to the magnetic axis of the Earth at the center. These results were also in full agreement with Christoph Birkeland's remarkable experiments with cathode rays directed towards a magnetic sphere described in 1901 in Fidensk Abelskabetz-Skrifter, Expedition Norvegienne de 1899-1900, Pour l'étude des aurores boreales. If now the wireless signals could penetrate the Heaviside layer, they would pass into this empty space and might be reflected by the walls of the electrons forming its outer boundary. The long time interval between the principal signal and these echoes agrees well with the immense dimensions of these toroidal spaces. There you go. That's it. That is the shape of our realm. We know very well, and there's a reason, there are a lot of reasons for that, but that is one of the fundamental shapes to understand. Well, not only electromagnetism, but many different things, and even possibly to best understand the shape of this realm, an electromagnetic toroid, not space balls. And these remarkable echoes, the long-distance echoes, do feed into that. And you get it from the very beginning, before you get into all of the, well, diverging hypotheses and things like that, the gut reaction from people at the time suggested a toroid. And to this very day, yes, the electromagnetic, well, the magnetic field of the Earth is shown as a toroid, though you don't really see much going along with that besides the northern lights, aurora borealis, and the supposed southern lights, aurora australis, although that data and evidence seems dubious to me. It seems a little different in the south, of course. Well, either way, the hard facts and the truth of the data denote that there is a toroidal shape of this realm, and it is immense. When you have echoes of 9 seconds and more, up to, I think I read 40 seconds at the max, but that kind of delay, given the speed of the propagation of radio signals for an echo, even if it's multiple echoes, the smallest, shortest, quickest echoes already are a little bit, it's very telling, but the longer echoes, as they're not periodic, but they have their own signature, it suggests that the longer echoes further down the line, the echoes at 3 seconds, for example, because it's not a multiple of the shorter echo, it would have to be a reflection from a convergence from a different path or a different reflector. And since space is supposed to be empty space, it shouldn't be reflecting. And if it's a convergence, it should be very periodic. Well, we're not seeing that. That's the problem they have. Now, if you believe, as we do, that this realm is nothing like what they have been presenting, if it is indeed the shape of a toroid, so that such that the lights in the sky, the stars, the planets, the moons, and all of that stuff is either projected into this toroid or projected from a source within the toroid, whatever the case, the presence, the energies, the appearance of all these things are within the local, well, we'll call it atmosphere, but it's really within this electromagnetic toroid, which is the realm here on Earth. It's whatever shape the Earth is, space seems to be a toroid. And So when you take this data with these echoes and you plot it out, it makes the most sense for it to be reflections from within this massive toroid, which is a function of a multiple of, well, from the radius of the Earth. Now, why the radius? Why the radius? Why don't they talk about diameter, or rather circumference would make more sense? Well, they don't talk about that because that's not what the data is showing. So they have to come up with other theories to explain why, if the frequency changes, why that would be the case. But I didn't see that in all of the results. I only saw that mentioned once. Let's assume that the frequency coming back is the same. Well, when the frequency is the same that is reflected back, it's reflecting back from with timing that is consistent with there being a surface or a barrier, a reflector, or a shape that would produce a convergence, either way, that somehow maybe amplifies the signal a bit because it defies the inverse square law. Because the signal should diminish to negligible, less than negligible, if there is such a thing, over a few seconds. That should be very informative to the scientists who believe, though they understand this stuff probably even better than I do, they can understand the technicalities of it. Somehow, in their minds, they think they understand a signal from 13.5 billion miles away from the Voyager satellite, traveling at almost basically light speed for, 17 hours before it would reach his Earth, that could be received and separated from the noise background of radiation, and they can get the telemetry and download pictures of Pluto, whatever. No. I don't know how they shut their brains off for that. But when your brain is switched on and you're looking at this, you can see that the data, the results, show a kind of flexible toroidal shape of reflecting. So it's almost like a hard surface. Now, could it be a dome? I know a lot of people are wondering that, if it were flat and it were a dome. Well, I haven't really worked it out in my mind, but I would say that that would be on the table. Get it? Snow globe, dome, on the table? Ha! I'm referencing, well, there's a scene in Citizen Kane where he's searching for a snow globe and he finds it on the table. I have it in my channel trailer because it's very telling. But yeah, I think that should be looked at. Of course, they didn't work that out, and if I have time, maybe I will. These echoes between 3 and 15 seconds, sometimes echoes coming back 8 seconds after the principal signal, just the fact that these echoes would have any intensity at all. If it was a extremely reflective surface that far away, well, that's quite a distance to travel. It would almost have to be parabolic, or it would have to amplify it. I don't know. Now, the intensity, they do say the intensity drops. But, a lot of it is variable. And so it doesn't always work, but given the right conditions, the right geographic location, time of day, time of year, and solar conditions, then they're able to find these echo signals. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when they try to work the variables in, assuming the curvature of the Earth and all these factors, the direct evidence just doesn't support the go-to theories, the assumptions of what they would expect in these experiments. It confounds them. So what the conventional knowledge of it is, basically what they usually find is there is a usual echo with an interval of about a seventh of a second, and then a weaker echo about 3 seconds after the principal signal. Yeah, and the amplitude of the 3-second echo being between a tenth and a 20th intensity of the principal signal in strength is inexplicable by the normal understandings that they have. So I think for me personally, maybe for you as well, this kind of supports the idea that the realm is shaped like a toroid.